So we're on page 134, the meditation on the Lumrim. Like I said, you don't have to read along, you can just listen along. You like that. Okay, so having a consistent and continuous meditation practice produces stable changes in our mind. Yeah, notice consistent and continuous. That's the key. Okay, so, you know, they always say that, you know, taking one day of the week and just doing intense practice that day is great, but then if you don't do any practice for the rest of the week, you lose everything you gained on that one day. Yeah, and so it's very important to pace ourselves and learn to be balanced individuals, yeah, so that each day we can do some practice and reinforce what we did the previous day. And then at different times of the year, take periods out and, you know, like you're here coming to a retreat or a course or doing a meditation retreat or whatever. And at that time you you know, because it's more constant, you don't have so many other distractions and things to do, then, you know, you can really gain a lot. And then the challenge is to keep that up after you go home. Yeah, because it's very easy after you go home, then you just slip back into what you did before. And you have all the intention. I'm going to start. I'm going to do a session the night I get home. When you get home and then your partner wants to talk to you and, you know, the dog wants your attention and you have a pile of bills to pay and your kids are screaming, they haven't seen you, and, you know, you got to take care of all of that. Okay? Yeah? Your parrot is going, where have you been? Where have you been? Yeah. So, yeah. So, you know, you've got to be practical and know that that's going to happen. So don't get discouraged when it does. And, you know, do your best to try and keep yourself on some kind of consistent program. Okay. Even you live at a Dharma center. Sometimes Dharma centers, the work gets very big, and then people start missing the morning and evening meditations. So that's not very good. Here at the Abbey, we always make sure that we have morning and evening meditation because the work will always be there tomorrow. Now, yeah? Mona, it doesn't go away. So, yeah, sometimes it's tempting. Oh, I'll just skip meditation and do this little bit of work and then I'll get it done. No. You know, you have your meditation time, keep to it. Okay. Yeah, I was at one branch of Chengping's monastery and talking to some of the nuns there, and they were so busy arranging activities for the lay people that they didn't have time even to go to morning and evening chanting. So we had a big talk about that, didn't we? Yeah, because they really wanted to have more time for their own practice, and I encouraged them to, you know, that as monastics we should step up and make sure we keep up our energy for our practice. Otherwise we get worn out. Mm-hmm. All these worn out monastics. Okay. So His Holiness says, I would now like to outline how to do a regular daily meditation practice based on the Lumrim, which is called the stages of the path, in the hopes that you will implement this for your own and others' benefit. Now, one challenge in the Tibetan tradition is there are so many practices to do. And as soon as you start getting into Tantra, you know, then you often get commitments to do certain practices every day, or certain recitations, or recite a certain number of mantra every day. So you have to be very, very careful with this, because otherwise, like in my generation, they gave us the same commitments that they gave the Tibetans, and so some of us wound up with hours, like 2 or 3 hours of commitments to do certain practices and recitations. The benefit of that is that you do them, you know, even though you're exhausted and you don't do them very well. That's the downside of it, okay? You know, it's better, it would be really nice to have it sometimes to think, oh, fewer practices, but I could do them well, instead of having to rush through them, because otherwise they consume so much time. Yeah, so I really recommend that people are careful about that and don't take a lot of commitments that, you know, some commitments are good because they really keep you on track to doing some practice every day, but don't take so many that then you don't have time for the Lam Rim, and that you have to do your practices very quickly because there's so many of them that you promise to do. Okay, that's just my personal advice. But you'll see our teachers, you know, like they'll be teaching, and they'll teach, and then while the translator's translating, they'll be doing their recitations. You know, I mean, that's what they have to do if you're teaching a big course for, you know, a few hours every day, and you have many hours of recitations while the translator's translating, you're doing your recitation, you know. It's not the best way to do things, you know, but you do the best you can, okay? Like I said, the Tibetans love to do recitations, you know, all day, all night. There's no lack of things to recite, yeah, which is good, because if you recite and you meditate on what you're reciting, it has a powerful impact on your mind. If you just, you know, are doing it because, you know, and your mind is somewhere else, then it's another issue altogether. Okay. With a strong foundation gained through meditation on the Lam Rim, your natural perspective on life will be the Buddhist worldview, and your character will be shaped by the aspirations for liberation, bodhicitta, and wisdom. Some people prefer to read a Dharma book, review notes taken during oral teachings, listen to recordings, or watch videos of Dharma talks before meditating so that they can meditate on the meaning of what they just studied. Yeah, this is really good if you can do that, you know. You read something, or you review your notes, and then you immediately think about it. It's fresh in your mind. It's quite good to do that. Other people prefer to meditate first and study later. Such time for study, reflection, and meditation is important for your emotional, physical, and spiritual health. Make a place for this quiet time in your life and let it become a habit. You'll experience the benefits. So we always nourish our body. We don't miss meals. Yeah, we should make sure we nourish our heart and mind in a similar way and not miss our meditation practice. And, you know, it sometimes takes a little bit of discipline. I mean, in a monastery, it's much easier because there's a daily schedule. And so everybody's doing the same thing at the same time. And if you aren't there doing the same thing at the same time, your absence is noticed and people will comment on it. And so it becomes very easy. You know, everybody's going to the hall, you go to the hall too. You don't think about it. Yeah, you don't think, oh, what else could I be doing now? Because everybody's going toward, you know, here. So you just do it, and it's very helpful for getting the practice done. You know, it's much more difficult to be on your own, especially monastics being on their own. I don't recommend it at all, because you know, you get up and then, well, you know, yeah, I have my practice, but I can do it a little bit later because I'll do something else first and then I'll do my practice. But then you start doing something else and that leads to something else and something else, and then your practice doesn't get done. Okay? Whereas, you know, if you're in a community and everybody's doing the same thing at the same time, you do too. So there's a virtual group affiliated with the Abbey, a Zoom group, I think. So you Zoom to your meditation cushion. So you check in with everybody, and they meditate at the same time we do, I think. Yeah, don't they? No. Yeah, at the same time we do. And so you check in, and you do your practice, and then, you know, everybody is looking out for everybody to make sure, you know, the other people are signing in every day. So it's quite good. Yeah, it's a good system. Okay. The best time for meditation is in the early morning, as the mind is clearer and sharper then, and not yet distracted by the day's activities. Can you feel that in your mind? You know, what happens if, you know, do that practice early in the morning one day and then do it at 10 o'clock in the morning the next day? Boy, there's a big difference. Yeah? It's much harder to get through it at 10 o'clock. Some people are evening people. They like to meditate in the evening. That's great. I mean, if you can do that. Evening time is not a good time for me. I just do my things quickly because I'm tired. Okay, but other people, you know, they like to meditate in the evening. Things are over for the day. It's quiet. They can focus better. But then many people tell me that when they do that, they also fall asleep. So, you know, I think it's good to start the day with your practice because it sets a good motivation for the day and gets you going on a, you know, in a good way. Familiarizing yourself with wholesome thoughts and emotions in the morning influences how you live the rest of the day, especially if you generate bodhicitta, which opens your heart to all sentient beings. And remember that people and things are transient and lack an independent nature, which reduces your grasping. Okay, so you think about those two things in the morning. It's very helpful. If your schedule doesn't permit you to meditate in the morning, get up earlier and don't do so much the night before. That's my commentary. His Holiness says, meditate at another time in the day when you can relax and will not be interrupted. I think it's easier to do less the night before and go to bed earlier than get up earlier. I think that works better. Although meditating for an hour is good, if that is not possible, do what is comfortable for you. Conclude before you feel tired so that you will have a positive feeling about meditation. Pushing yourself to meditate for longer than you are comfortably able to will make your mind resistant to future practice. 10 minutes of good quality meditation is better than sitting for an hour with a distracted or sleepy mind. Okay. However, that is not an excuse to sit for 10 minutes and then say, oh, I'm so distracted, I might as well get up. Okay. Okay, however, a person who is very busy and has little fortitude will find meditation almost impossible. He should just do a short prayer and then finish. That's best. So you do refuge in bodhicitta, dedication, you know, At least it's something. Yeah, but it's better if you can do something a little bit more hearty. You know, I mean, when you eat breakfast, do you just have a glass of water? Yeah? Or do you eat something that's going to nourish you? So it's the same way with your spiritual practice. To get up early, we may have to sacrifice late night activities in order to go to bed earlier. This may be easier for me to do because I live in a monastic environment in Dharamsala, an Indian town that, it says here, is fairly quiet in the evening. An Indian town that used to be fairly quiet in the evening and no longer is. Although where His Holiness is, it's a little bit quieter. He's out of the town itself. In other places, there is entertainment and social life, so sticking to a regular schedule of daily meditation may be more challenging. You know, you can go out with your friends, you can have a Skype call, you can chat, you can, you know, catch up on news. So, you know, you can make appointments, go out for coffee with your friends, and everybody puts their phone on the table. And then you have to pick up your phone and check it every 5 minutes. Otherwise, the friends that you arranged to meet think that you don't have a life. So while you're with the friends that you're meeting, you are texting to make arrangements to meet other people. Okay. And then when you're with them, you don't spend your time with them because you're texting to make arrangements to meet with another group. Yeah, and then our whole life goes like that, doesn't it? Yeah. But first thing, I mean, I'm astounded. I don't go out to restaurants very often. It's not my favorite place. But when I do, it's like everybody sits down. Hello, how are you? Take their phone out, put it on the table, right smack in front of them. So everybody's sitting there with their phone out. And then everybody has to check their phone every few minutes. Yeah. And even if you get a message from, you know, one of those random messages, they're trying to sell you something, it's okay because it looks like you're important because you're getting a lot of text messages. So you have a life. Yeah. Right? Yeah. And then you got to check and see how your kids are. My sister has this thing where she could find out where her kids are at any time. Yeah, her kids are 21 and 23. Yeah. Huh? Yeah, it can, you know, their phones are linked. So, you know, she can find out where they are at any specific time. Yeah? So she doesn't spy on them, but she worries, you know, and so this way she can check up and, you know, where are they? And yeah, so you spend your whole life, you know, with the phone and nothing much, you know, what other life do you have besides that? You know, except listening to Twitter, you know? I don't look at Twitter, but it's like these people. I mean, do you want to read how many characters can you write now? They upped it, so it's maybe 200 and something. Do you want to sit there and read people's thoughts in like 200 characters? You know, I mean, what can people say? Yeah, encouraging them in virtue. What are you doing? And what are the Twitters saying that you read? Are you signed up for politicians' tweets? Yeah. Tweets, what a word. Yeah. I'm tweeting. Yeah. And then, you know, you have to take your phone everywhere with you, even into the bathroom, because you don't want to miss anything. Yeah. I don't have a phone. I don't want to be available 24/7. You know, I don't want to be. There's no necessity to be available 24/7. Okay. Yeah, some people, you know, go to sleep first thing in the morning. I have 50 tweets to read, you know, and 45 text messages. Anything important here? No, but they're all to me, so they must be important. Yeah. And then, you know, your boyfriends and girlfriends break up on you know, on their phones. Yeah. Sorry, nice knowing you. Bye. Yeah. We've been living together for 5 years. I'm moving out this afternoon. We're done, over with. Don't tweet me back. No negotiation. And you don't have to see the other person's face. You don't have to be responsible for how, you know, the effect of on your words to other people. You know, you can say whatever you want and badmouth anybody and criticize people and make up lies, and nobody's gonna find out who you are because you operate under a fake name. Yeah? And then even you sign up on a dating app and you don't know if the person actually looks like their picture or if they are the person that they wrote the profile for. Yeah, so, you know, you never tell somebody how you feel. You just put up a face. Yeah. Yeah. You know, you don't bother to say, I love you. You put up a happy face. And you don't bother to say what you know, I think I misinterpreted what you said and my feelings are really hurt. We need to talk. You know, you just put, what do you put up for an emoji for that? Yeah, emoji, like, you know. Yeah? So, oh, goodness, yeah? So, yeah, so I think, actually, to have a good meditation practice, you need to disconnect from a good portion of the internet, you know? I mean, including the ads, all the advertising, you know, and how many Russian tweets are you getting? Especially, you know, with the elections coming up, you know, and you could be reading all sorts of, you know, conspiracy theories and invented in the dark corners of the internet. Huh? And you read this stuff and it affects you and, oh, yeah, you know, maybe it was Ukraine that interfered with our elections. It wasn't Russia. You know, the CIA, FBI, they don't know what they're talking about. It was Ukraine. Yeah. And you start believing all that nonsense. Just as daily meals and exercise are necessary to keep our body healthy, daily spiritual practice is essential for our mental well-being and progress towards awakening. Okay, meditations consist of three parts: the preparation, the actual practice, and the conclusion. Okay, so sleep, open your eyes, and sleep again. Okay. The preparation involves taking refuge in the Buddhas. Oops. The Buddhas, the Dharma, and the Sangha, generating the bodhicitta motivation to attain full awakening for the benefit of sentient beings, and purifying and creating merit. That's the preparation. The actual practice is meditating on the Lam Rim topic for that session. At the conclusion, dedicate the merit created to attain Buddhahood and lead all sentient beings to awakening as well. try to avoid developing bad habits in your meditation. I should listen to this part. As in other activities, correcting a bad habit in our meditation practice is more difficult than establishing a new habit. Pay attention to the meditation instructions and do your best to follow them. If necessary, you can adjust them slightly to suit your personal needs and situation. Okay, so now we're getting into the six preparatory practices. So these in the preparation, actual practice, and conclusion, this is the preparation part. Okay, when describing how to structure a meditation session, Lam Rim texts begin with the six preparatory practices that are done before the actual practice. These are cleaning the room, arranging the altar, making offerings, sitting in the correct meditation position, taking refuge in generating bodhicitta, contemplating the seven limbs, and requesting inspiration from our root and lineage spiritual mentors. That's seven. Okay. Oh, taking refuge in generating bodhicitta is one. Yeah. Okay, then we got down to five. Anyway, there's six. You can just figure out which variety of six you want. Okay, no, but here we can look. Cleaning the room is one, making and arranging the altar, making offerings, sitting in the correct meditation position, taking refuge in generating bodhicitta is one. Okay, and then the seven limbs should be, Yeah. Six. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So cleaning the room and arranging the altar. So begin by cleaning the room and arranging the altar to enhance the environment in which you meditate and beautify the place where you will invite the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to come. Yeah. So remember, you're inviting the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to come and sit in the space in front of you. So you want to do this in a nice place, not, you know, a messy place. Cleaning the environment is analogous to cleansing your mind and making it more receptive. Meditating in an uncluttered and peaceful room is best, not in the same room as the television, computer, or your children's toys. However, if that is not possible, do your meditation session in whatever space is available. It is not necessary to have a separate room for meditation. If you can make a special corner or another room, that's very good. If you can't, then at least have some uncluttered place where you can set up a shrine and, sit in without being interrupted. Okay, so not near your telephone. Of course, don't bring your phone with you. Not near the computer. Not near, you know, like where you have your whole mess spread out. Okay? Yeah. I'm going to apply the Dharma to my life. This mess in front of me. Yeah, I mean, if your room is a mess, if you're office is a mess. If your office is a mess, if your office is a mess, if your office is a mess, it is indicative also of the state of your mind. Okay, so it's very helpful to have a clean environment and a clean office. Yeah, and a clean car. Yeah, these things show the state of your mind. Yeah. I remember staying at one nunnery, and there was a younger nun who was kind of taking care of me, and she invited me to her room. It a room completely, you know, like spick and span and uncluttered and, you know, just, yeah. And then she wanted to show me her cupboards, so she opened her cupboard full of stuff. It was all folded very nicely, but totally full of stuff. Okay? So I learned something about my friend that day. Yeah? So you learn a lot by looking at the environment that they have around them. I don't look in their drawers. I figure, you know, the drawers are off limit. But you can see, you know, what's around. People's bathrooms are especially interesting. You know, how many types of hand lotion and hair dye and hair conditioner and makeup and, you know, all the different things to make your body nice and all that. Very interesting, you know, to see what's in people's bathrooms. And without looking in the drawers, it's all just out there. I don't know how they find any of it because there's so many bottles. Uh-oh, I'm revealing how I look at people's stuff. You're not going to invite me into your houses again. Yeah, out of fear that I talk about your bathroom teaching. Okay. Okay. On a table, so here's how to set up your altar. On a table, and the table should be higher than where you're sitting, and at least at eye level, you know, not so you're looking down on the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, but so that you're looking either straight ahead or best yet if you're looking up, okay? Okay, so on a table, set up the symbols of the Buddha's body, speech, and mind. So statue is the symbol of the Buddha's body. The Dharma text is of speech, and the stupa is the mind. So place the image of Shakyamuni Buddha in the center, as he is the founder and source of the teachings. I am sad to see that nowadays some people place meditational deities and not the Buddha at the center of their altars, as if they value the meditational deities more than the Buddha. Seeing the Buddha's image reminds you of his qualities, which gladdens and motivates your mind. Avoid buying costly Buddha images with the motivation to show them off to your friends, and cultivate an attitude of respect for all Dharma items. In our Kuan Yin room, the center, we have a large Kuan Yin statue there. If you look above, there's a small Buddha image. Okay, so we try to do that in my room. There's a large Manjushri statue, but there's a Buddha image off to the side and another one on top of the bookshelf. Okay, the way you place them, the Buddha's in the center. On the right, the Buddha's right, you usually put the texts. We have the Kangyur and also the Tengyur, so they're on both sides. The Kangyur are the Buddha's sutras, what the Buddha spoke. The Tengyur are the commentaries and treatises by the great Indian Pandits. Okay, so they're the Buddha's speech. This is the Buddha's body. The stupa is the symbol of the Buddha's mind. You can also put a bell if you don't have a stupa. Yeah, if you... you know, don't have things like this, you can also use a picture of the Buddha, a picture of the stupa, things like that, okay? And then you usually have your teacher's picture above, okay? So here we just put His Holiness's picture. Our altar is rather small. Some people's altars, you know, they're really crowded with things, so we try and keep it simple here. And also because people have different teachers, so we don't have all all the teachers of everybody who lives at the Abbey around. So we keep His Holiness as our central one. But in your room, you may have pictures of your other teachers. And it's very nice to have an image of the Buddha, because when you go through your day, you know, sometimes you're just tired, you're flabbergasted, you're frustrated. You walk past your shrine and you see the Buddha, and the Buddha's just sitting there, so peaceful. Yeah. And you look and you go, oh yeah, I can be like that too. So it reminds you to, you know, come back to what's important. So having the shrine there, I think, is quite nice, you know, in your house somewhere. Okay, then the second one is making offerings. So making offerings enables you to create vast merit and cultivate the mind that delights in giving. Offer items that are pure in two regards. First, they are procured honestly through right livelihood. Okay. Obtaining offerings, avoid obtaining offerings, or for that matter, daily life requisites, through the five wrong livelihoods of flattery, hinting, giving a small gift in the hopes of receiving a large one, coercion, or hypocrisy. Okay. Let's look at those a little bit closer. So you don't want to offer things that you procured in a way that is more or less dishonest or with a kind of corrupted motivation. Okay? So you don't want to offer things or your daily life requisites, okay, through hinting. Okay? So, Susan, you know that jacket you got me last year was really, really nice. And I wore it all last year and it got really worn out, but I so much appreciate your getting it for me. Okay, is that a good hint? Yeah? Okay. So that's hinting. Yeah, it looks, that's hinting. Yeah, that's the second one. The first one was flattery. Okay. So, Margaret, you know, that jacket you got me, you have really good taste because you picked out just exactly the perfect jacket. And, you know, and I've been to your house, and your house is so nicely decorated. It's so obvious that you're really a sincere person and very, very generous. Okay, that's flattery. Yeah? Okay, I should be getting a lot of presents soon, huh? Okay. Okay, flattery, hinting, giving a small gift in the hopes of receiving a large one. Sarah, I know that you need some tissues, and you know, I don't have a lot, but I'm going to give you my package of tissues, and it's a very beautiful look. Isn't this nice with all the pink flowers on the package of tissues? And, you know, I really want you to have it. And, you know, please know that I'm giving it because I'm so fond of you. Okay, will you accept my tissues? Oh, good. Okay. Giving a small gift. That one's really small. And okay, coercion. Oh, Sydney. You know, we're raising money for the Buddha Hall, and everybody in this room has pledged to give a $500 for the Buddha Hall. How much are you pledging? That's coercion. Okay. And then hypocrisy. Okay, so you should come to my room, see how nice my altar is, how nice my room is. I've written all these books. They're all over the place. Yeah, so I'm a very wonderful Dharma practitioner. But don't look on my computer as to what websites I've been looking at and how much time I've spent looking at those websites. You know? So making yourself look like a holy practitioner, but... yeah. Okay. So we don't want to get offerings by doing that kind of thing, because it's not really kosher, is it? You know, we don't have we're getting things, but without a pure motivation. Okay, second, it says offer items that are pure in two regards. So first, you didn't get them by the five-arm livelihoods. Second, the offerings are given with a pure motivation, a sincere wish to practice the Buddha Dharma for the sake of all beings, not simply to receive some benefit for this life alone or to have a beautiful altar. Okay, so you remember my picture of me with my llama? Yeah, that's on a prominent place on the altar, which is in the living room. So when you come in my room, you know, everybody will make sure that they see me. And he signed it. Okay, so you don't want to have that going on. And you don't want to make offerings with the motivation. You know, sometimes you may pray for worldly things, but it should also be within the whole purview of creating merit for the benefit of all sentient beings. But some people forget about the global picture of creating merit, you know, to dedicate for the enlightenment of all beings. And they're kind of doing business with the Buddha, okay? I find this a lot in Asian countries. So Buddha, you know, here's a big plate of fruit, and I'm offering it to you, and please, may my son marry a good woman. May my daughter get a good job. Yeah, and so I'm really praying for them to do well. And here's this fruit. Okay. So some people do like that, you know. They make an offering, and they dedicate it for a worldly thing. Other people are more clever businessmen. Buddha, please may I win the lottery. And if I do, then I'll give you a portion of it. Okay. Buddha, may my company really take off and make a lot of money. And then I'll make a donation to the temple. So first, Buddha, you do your part, and then I'll make the offering. Okay, it's really like doing business with the Buddha. Okay, so we should abandon that, you know, state of mind. Like I said, you know, we can make offerings and pray for, you know, removal of obstacles and things in this life. That's fine. But put it in the bigger picture of, you know, may all sentient beings benefit, and I'm giving it for the welfare, you know, with the welfare of all sentient beings in mind, or I'm giving it with compassion, something like this, yeah. Okay, we may offer things from our own culture and items easily available in the place where we live. It is not necessary to imitate Tibetan-style offerings. In Tibet, we make food offerings and tormas. Tormas are, they translate it as ritual cakes, but there are these things that are kind of shaped like this, and they're made out of sampa. Yeah. Now, if you make tormas out of Tibetan sampa, sampa is ground barley flour. So if you have really good quality sampa, and you add some butter and a little sugar and maybe some Tibetan cheese, you can make really nice tasting tormas. And you want to offer something nice tasting to the Buddha. But in the West, people want something that looks like a torma, but doesn't necessarily taste like one. So they'll use, you know, just regular flour and add some water and, you know, and make it in the shape of the torma and put the butter sculptures on, made out of Play-Doh. yeah, so it looks like a torma, but you wouldn't eat it yourself, so why are you offering it to the deities and to the Buddha? Okay? So, you know, some people want something that looks Tibetan and like the real, you know, that. But I think, you know, we should offer something that, I mean, I should offer something that I think is good tasting, not something that just looks like a Tibetan torma, but nobody would eat. You know, I certainly wouldn't, if His Holiness was coming for dinner or any of my teachers, I certainly wouldn't offer that to them. Okay. So His Holiness often talks about how we try and imitate Tibetan things. You know, we get Tibetan clothes and, you know, tormas. Actually, in ancient India, tormas were made out of fish, you know, or some other kind of thing. Although, how would they make fish without killing the fish? I don't know, but I read that somewhere that they were made out of fish. Maybe some other thing. Yeah, like katas in ancient India, they weren't like the katas that she taught you how to offer today. There were garlands of flowers, and if you go to India today, what do people offer each other? These garlands of these beautiful marigolds, yeah, bright orange marigolds. They're beautiful. But they didn't have those in Tibet, so they made katas. Yeah. So we could, you know, probably give a telephone cord. I don't know. But, you know, something. I'm joking. But, you know, something that we consider beautiful. Yeah. We don't have to copy everything the Tibetans do. So in Tibet, we made food offerings and tormas out of sampa because it was readily available. But in the West, sampa is hard to come by, and it seems strange to eat one thing and offer something else to the three jewels. Okay? So I eat really nice food, and then I offer this, you know, wheat flour mixed with water to the Buddha, you know. So His Holiness says, so fruit, cookies, and other foods that you consider delicious instead of tormas made of sampa. Okay. Chocolate chip cookies. Yeah. Or nice fruit, you know. So we should offer things that we would eat that we think are good. Okay. So you don't put, you know, your leftover macaroni and cheese that's been sitting in the fridge for 3 days on the altar. Yeah. You know, we should have fresh food and nice food and, you know, things that we would eat ourselves or that we would offer to a guest. Yeah. So then His Holiness says, you know, after recommending these other kinds of foods, he says, I do this when traveling in other countries. Yeah? So you use what's available. Yeah? Very often now when we use tormas, what we have vases with things with food in them, Or you can take a can of fruit and put it up, use that as a torma. I have one friend who wraps it in wrapping paper and puts a bow on it, or makes the shape of the things that a torma has on front and sticks that on with tape on the paper that's wrapping the can of fruit. So, you know, you can do that kind of thing as well. Most important, the offerings to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas should be the same or better quality than what we eat. Avoid making lavish offerings with the hidden motivation of eating them later. Okay, so don't offer things that, you know, but we should offer what is the really good quality. So it's not like, you know, you went out, you got some apples, you look at them, oh, these ones are bruised, I'll offer those and then I'll keep the good ones. No, we should offer the good ones and we eat the bruised ones. Okay? And, you know, I see this also, you know, in many places. They'll come to the temple over in the weekend, you know, and make very beautiful offerings. And then they decide to take the offerings down just at the time when they would eat dessert. Yeah? So it seems like they're just putting the food on the altar so that it has somewhere to sit while they do their practice. And then when they're ready to eat it, they take it back from the Buddha. Okay? So we should avoid having a mind like that. Tibetans know that soak offerings will later be distributed to the assembly, so they use delicious ingredients to make them. But the tormas that will not be eaten are made of cheap ingredients and sometimes taste so bad that no one would even want to eat them. This is not as it should be. Okay. Arrange the offerings nicely, with respect for the three jewels and with the motivation that the Buddha Dharma long endure and sentient beings benefit from it. So last night with the soak, the way the light offerings were made and the everything was arranged, it was very beautiful. Yeah? So that's much better than, you know, you just throw things on the altar. Whether we are able to offer a lot or a little, our motivation is most important because it is the purity of our intention that determines the value of our actions. Although Milarepa was impoverished, he gained high realizations because of his strong faith, correct motivation, and joyous effort. Okay? So it doesn't matter, you know, whether you offer a lot or a little, or if you're rich or poor, what matters is the motivation with which you're giving. However, if you you should not, you know, buy expensive things for yourself because you have a lot of money and then offer one piece of popcorn to the Buddha. Yeah, something like that. We should, we should offer according to our means. It doesn't need to be lavish, but it shouldn't be cheap either. Okay. Okay. And then what you offer, then at the end of the day, you can take down. And then you give it to other people or you consume it yourself or whatever. Okay. We generally don't, the soak offerings in particular, we don't give to animals directly. I mean, the soak lot that's taken out in the middle of the ceremony, we put out, animals eat it. We can't help that, but we're not offering it to them. Yeah. Okay. So then sitting in the correct meditation position. If you can, sit in the seven-point position of Buddha Vairochana, as outlined in the explanatory Tantra Vajramala. Sitting in this way enables the body to remain firm and the mind steady. It also aids the flow of the subtle energies in the body. So, first one, sit on a cushion of whatever size and shape works best for you with your legs in the Vajra position, okay? So that is your left foot is on the right thigh and your right foot is on the left thigh. Some people call that the lotus position. The lotus position is actually different. That position that I just described is called the Vajra position. Okay, if this isn't possible, other cross-legged positions are fine. So, for example, have your left leg on your right thigh and then your right leg in front down on the ground. Or if you can't do that, sit like Tara is with your right leg tucked in and your left in front of it. Or sit a regular cross-legged position if you can't do that. Okay. Some people find sitting on a slanted meditation bench enables their back to be straight, and it is easier on the knees. You may also sit on a straight back chair with your feet flat on the floor. So you don't want to be meditating with your legs crossed. If you can sit on the floor, that's best. Okay. If you have physical ailments that don't allow you to do that, then make the adjustments either with a bench or sitting on a chair. And if you have a chair, have a straight back chair. You know, the kind of chairs that the red ones that we have here are really not very good because you lean back. You should have a straight back when you're meditating. Okay, then you put your right hand on top of the left with the palms up. Touch the thumbs together lightly and put your hands in your lap near your navel. Okay, so your hands are against your body. They're not stretched out in front of you. But the right's on the left and your thumbs are lightly touching. Okay, so this enables the energy winds to flow in a very good way throughout the body. So really sit like that. Then keep your shoulders level, not like that, okay, straighten your back, yeah, that one could be hard, you know, if you spend time on the computer, then slowly your back becomes like this, yeah. You're meditating like this, yeah. If your head's drooping, what happens? You know, you're going to fall asleep. Okay, shoulders level, straighten your back. Tuck your chin in slightly so that the tip of your nose is aligned with your navel, but don't let your head droop. Okay, so you just slightly tuck your chin in. You don't go like this. Okay, and other people, because of the computer or because of having bifocals, they often are in a habit of raising their head up like this. You don't want that either because that will cause a lot of distraction and scatteredness. Keep your lips and teeth natural with your tongue on the upper palate to prevent thirst as well as excess saliva. Not quite sure where else your tongue would be, but, you know, but in other words, you don't meditate unless, you know, you have a cold and you can't breathe. You know, you don't want your mouth, you know, like this. Yeah, you see some people, you know, they walk around all day, their mouth is kind of like that. So just have your mouth, you know, your mouth in a natural expression. You don't need to frown. Or smile. Okay, then direct your eyes towards the tip of your nose. You're not looking at the tip of your nose, so don't try and make yourself cross-eyed, okay? So it's just more your eyes are like somewhere around here, or if that's difficult, direct your gaze downwards in front of you without focusing on anything. okay? As your mind becomes more concentrated, you will cease to notice what comes in your field of vision, okay? So when your eyes are a little bit open, downwards, you're not looking at anything, so you don't want to get distracted. But by having the eyes open a little bit, then light comes in and that prevents drowsiness. So if you're having a problem with drowsiness, you know, try and keep your eyes a little bit open, but looking down, you know, down here and not really looking at anything. Okay. Keeping your eyes slightly open when you meditate prevents drowsiness. If your eyes are focused on an attractive object, distraction will easily arise. So place them on a neutral object, okay? And don't look around while you're doing your practice. Yeah, it's not like you're sitting in the hall and then, you know. And then you make eye contact with somebody else and you quickly close your eyes. Okay, so you shouldn't be looking around when you're chanting or when you're meditating, okay? So, you know, when we're chanting, we should be visualizing the Buddha in front, yeah, and focused on what we're saying. We shouldn't be looking around, tipping our head, or gazing at the stars, or seeing what other people are doing, okay? Our eyes should be lowered, and we should be focused on what we're chanting and doing the visualization that goes with the chant as well. Okay, although your eye consciousness may see an object, don't focus on it or let the mental consciousness, the meditating consciousness, get involved with it. Do not intentionally close your eyes, but if they naturally close, it is fine. If you become accustomed to meditating with your eyes slightly open, restraining your senses in break time will be easier because you are already used to ignoring sense data. And so that's one of the practices in the break time, is to restrain our senses, to not always be looking at, you know, everything around us and all the people around us and everything that's in the stores that we're walking by, okay, but to restrain the senses. The position of, so that's what we do in the break time. If you can keep your eyes a little bit open with light going in, but not really looking at anything during the meditation time, then it's much easier in the break time to restrain your senses. Okay, the position of the eyes may differ according to the practice. When doing the Kala Chakra practice, the eyes are open and look up. In Dzogchen, the eyes are open and look straight ahead. So it's different according to the practice. Your physical position should be firm yet relaxed. Avoid tensing your muscles. You know, it shouldn't be like that, okay? Sitting erect helps the mind be clear and alert, while lying down often leads to sleep. So don't make it a practice of lying down when you're doing your practices. You know, just sit up in some way. However, this may not be true for people with different habits or cultural backgrounds. So judge for this for yourself. So there's this story in one of the scriptures of one of the Buddha's disciples who liked to meditate lying down. And that is not, indicated as being a helpful position at all. But he did that because in his previous life he was a cow and he was used to lying down. Okay. Depending on the layout of the room, facing east is recommended because the sun rises there and light uplifts your mental attitude and dispels mental sluggishness. Sitting in a well-lit room also serves that purpose if you struggle with drowsiness. But if your mind is easily excited, you may face the wall, but otherwise it is not necessary to do that. I know in the Zen tradition, often they meditate facing the wall to avoid distraction. It's not necessary to do that, although some people find it helpful. Okay. Also, if you tend to get sleepy during your meditation, then make sure you sit up straight. Put cold water on your face and on your head before the session. Do some prostrations to get your body moving and to do some, it purifies karma before you sit down. And then don't wrap yourself up with so many clothes and blankets. If you're a little bit cold when you meditate, you won't fall asleep. Whereas if, you know, you have 5 t-shirts and 15 sweaters and a few blankets and your hat and your scarf and you're sitting in an 80-degree room, you know, you might easily fall asleep. So if you have problems with drowsiness, you know, really, you know, don't keep your body so warm when you're meditating. The Vairochana posture is sometimes said to have 8 points. In this case, calming the mind by observing the breath is added to the above 7. This is especially helpful to do if your mind is agitated. Breathe in and out in a natural, even rhythm without undue noise or effort. Do not force your breath. Sometimes you're in a room with people who like to do deep breathing. Don't be that person, you know? It's not good for you, and it doesn't, it isn't pleasing for your fellow meditators. Okay. If you're somebody who coughs a lot, have a stack of cough drops on your table so that whenever you start coughing, you don't have to get up and go get one. If you cough a lot, you know that happens. Have them there, have them unwrapped, so you just have to go like that without getting up, picking one up, coming back, crinkle, 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 and then, you know. Okay. You know, there's just certain things that you ways of practicing courtesy to fellow meditators. Okay, place your attention on the breath, experiencing and observing each breath without letting the mind stray to other objects. If you get distracted by a sound, thought, or physical sensation, simply acknowledge it and then return your attention to the gentle flow of the breath. In this way, let your mind calm down in preparation for taking refuge and generating bodhicitta. Okay, so you do the breathing just for a few minutes, not for a long time, enough to quiet the mind a little bit. Meditation on the breath may be done in several ways and for different purposes in both Buddhist and non-Buddhist contexts. Here, it is done to calm the mind before meditating on the stages of the path. Meditations to develop serenity and insight using the breath as the object of meditation will be discussed later. So that's a whole other way of meditating on the breath. After observing the breath for a few minutes, examine your mind to see if any afflictions are present. If they are, reflect that you have experienced much misery in this and previous lives by following attachment, anger, and confusion. Make a firm determination not to get entangled with them, but to do your practice with focus. So that can be very helpful at the beginning of your session. You think, you know, I've spent many lifetimes following attachment and anger and confusion, and now I'm going to really make a determined effort not to do that, but to focus my mind on the meditation I'm doing. Okay, so maybe we'll do some Q&A now.
Might be a silly question, but I've wondered with the Vajra position, where it's the leg up and then the right kind of on the top, and then you put if you can't do the full Vajra position, you put the right leg down and have the left up.
No, yes. You usually have the left up and then the right in front.
Yeah. I naturally do the other way around. But is it, I'm presuming that it's significant. I didn't know, don't know why. Thank you.
Yeah. Put that in the box with, yeah. We should have a box of questions that your teacher can't answer, and maybe you can find somebody to answer them one day. And maybe you'll figure it out yourself one day. And maybe you won't. Oh, you have another one. Now go ahead and ask.
If the meditational deities are Buddhas, and the Buddha sure, the aspect of what Buddha Vajradhara to teach the tantras and then was those Buddhas, then trying to understand His Holiness's comment about feeling sad that the meditational deities are in the center of the altar.
Because the Buddha was the founder of the Dharma in our historical age, you know. It wasn't the Buddha in the aspect of Manjushri or the Buddha in the aspect of you know, some other deity. It was the Buddha as a human being who appeared on this earth and taught the Dharma. Yeah, so he's the one who turned the Dharma wheel, and everything, all those deities are, you know, they're coming from the Buddha, so we really need to have the Buddha first and foremost in front of us.
When we were talking about emptiness, and when that's appropriate to introduce to people. Mm-hmm. I have this question. In our Dharma Center, we often have totally new people who, you know nothing or next to nothing. And we usually do the Buddha Sadhana. Mm-hmm. And there's a spot where it says, meditate on emptiness. Mm-hmm. And so, you know that paragraph, yeah. Obviously. So, you know, I wonder sometimes if we should not make that pause when we have people who know nothing, if it matters.
I think that's okay to make that pause because they don't know anything, so they're not, you know, hopefully they won't think, oh, that there's just nothing. You know, hopefully they won't think that. So I think meditate, or you could be more specific, meditate on the emptiness of inherent existence. Okay. And if you say that, then the people think, oh, what's the emptiness of inherent existence? And they won't think that it means just nothingness.
Or oneness.
Yeah, you don't want them thinking it's oneness.
I think that's probably more common. Yeah. I just see that out in the world. If you say emptiness, people think oneness.
Oneness, yeah. So maybe just say the emptiness of inherent existence, you know, and then leave, the time for it. And new people, I mean, hopefully they'll figure out, oh, it's the first time I'm coming here. I don't really understand everything, but that's okay. Yeah. And then if those people come afterwards and say, oh, what does emptiness mean? Then you can just say, It means that everything depends on other things, you know, causes and conditions and parts, and that nothing exists on its own. Just say that for somebody who's brand new. Okay. Okay, then I guess I'll keep reading. So, taking refuge and generating bodhicitta. The process of taking refuge and generating bodhicitta begins with visualizing the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in the space in front of you. You may do the simple visualization of Shakyamuni Buddha, thinking he is the embodiment of all the Buddha's Dharma and Sangha. Or you can do the complex visualization with the lineage, teachers, deities, Buddhas, bodhisattvas, and so on, surrounding the central figure of Shakyamuni. That tanka there, it shows in two dimensions what the three-dimensional refuge looks like. Okay, so you have the Buddha at the center. You have three groups of lamas, one on each side, in the back. They're not all sitting in the space above the Buddha if it's 3D. And then in circles around, the Buddha's a little bit higher, but then in circles around the Buddha, you have all the other figures, the other Buddhas, the deities, the bodhisattvas, arhats, Dharma protectors, dakas, dakinis, and so on. Okay, so you can get there's a whole teaching on where everybody sits and how it looks, but we didn't put it in the book because it's a little bit long. Okay, when meditating mainly on the method side of the path, the cultivation of renunciation, bodhicitta, and the like, you may want to visualize Avalokiteshvara and Maitreya near the Buddha. And when developing wisdom, you can imagine Manjushri next to the Buddha. When facing obstacles such as illness or injury, visualize Tara seated near the Buddha, and so on. So that's if you're doing just one figure, thinking the Buddha is the embodiment of all the other figures of refuge. Visualization is an imaginative process done in our minds. Do not think that you should see things as you do when your eyes are open. We are generating mental images in our mind's eye. For beginners, these images will be vague, but as we progress and develop familiarity with visualization, they will become more vivid. Okay. I'll just read a little bit more and then I'll stop. You may wonder why Tibetan Buddhism encourages visualization. Imagining the holy beings naturally makes us reflect on their awakened qualities. Thinking that we are in their presence creates a feeling of closeness with them. All of this strengthens our faith and confidence in the three jewels, which are more important than the clarity of the visualization. So don't worry so much about the clarity, yet go more for the feeling of sitting in the presence of all these holy beings, or sitting in the presence of the Buddha. To review, there are three types of faith: inspired, aspiring, and believing faith. We cultivate inspired faith by discerning and reflecting on the wonderful qualities of the three jewels, making our mind inspired with a vivid reflection of their qualities. To this joyous state of mind, we add understanding of the four truths of Aryas, which leads us to be convinced that the three jewels, particularly the Dharma jewel, which consists of the third and fourth truths, are non-deceptive objects of refuge that we can fully rely on to guide us to liberation and awakening. This is believing faith. Strengthening this faith, we gain stronger determination to not simply admire or believe in the three jewels, but to aspire to become like them. This is aspiring faith, which gives us great enthusiasm to practice. So there are three kinds of faith. Okay, so the next paragraph starts talking about the Mahayana practice of taking refuge. We'll save that for tomorrow. I want to be able to give it all at one thing instead of breaking it up. Okay.